to jump ahead bone-wise, because many of the muscles that we're going to be talking about eventually here, they are, you know, as I sort of explained last week, they do cross the wrist joint and affect the hand or the wrist, depending on where they go. So I have to sort of jump ahead to bones and get all the way down and finish the hand. So by the end of class today, well, no, before the end of class today, hopefully, we'll have all the bones done in the upper limb. So we have to get through these first and the joints as well, as far as that goes. So, so yeah, if you've got your hands, great. Anybody remember to bring their hands? Okay. All right. So, obviously, again, if you remember back from semester one, structure governs function. And, you know, again, you have to think in terms of the diverse movements that this hand can do in terms of gripping and all the variations of gripping and flexion and supination and all those sorts of things. Not the supinocational occurrence of the hand, but it's involved some with it. And because of that, then we have to have a lot of modifications in order to do the number of movements that it is. Now, I don't know if you guys remember, but inside mum, when you were developing, your foot was in the same position as your hand. So your great toe was inside mum at some point in the anatomical position. Your great toe was on the outside. And then at one point in development, the femurs internally rotate and lock into the hip joint. And you're going to discover in assessments that's why the nerve patterns for dermatomes actually twist around the leg, because when the nerves were created inside mum, the leg was with the toe out, and then they internally rotated to create the toes on the inside. The other thing is, in the brain, again, initially when a child's first born, the representation of function is equal between feet and hands in the brain. And then as we get older and start to grow and use our hands more, we kind of forget about our feet and all we do is think about our hands. And you probably have heard many stories where, you know, individuals who were born without hands or lost their hands then would train with their feet and then were able to use their feet almost like a hand. And if you watch a newborn with their toes, they do actually try to use their feet a little bit like their hands by gripping and those sorts of things, using their toes very similar to their hands. But then that all gets forgotten as time goes on, and the brain kind of becomes redundant with the feet and spends more time in the hands. Anyways, so the hand is the manual part of the upper limb and is the junction of the forearm and the hand. The digits are numbered 1 through 5, with the thumb being 1, all the way across to the little finger being 5. So this is considered to be a finger. This is number 1, okay? They also are named accordingly: thumb, index, middle, ring, and little. You will see those terms as well. Thumb, index, middle, ring, and little. All right? So you'll see those terms sometimes as well. The palmar aspect features the central concavity. So when you hold your hand just in the normal relaxed position, you'll note that the central palm is a concave, and then you have these two kind of thick eminences on either side. You have the thenar eminence, which is the base of the thumb, that thick, soft area here, base of the thumb, and the medial, smaller hypothenar eminence, which is the one that's related to the little finger, or is near the little finger, proximal to the little finger, or the fifth digit. Okay, so thenar eminence, hypothenar eminence. Yep.
What does the eminence mean?
Sticks out. It emanates. It's just kind of thick there. If you push on here, that's rare. If you push on here, that's medium rare. You ever do that with the barbecue? What's that?
This is rare.
Yep.
Medium.
Oh, you can do that way too. Yeah. So you really should, when you're cooking a steak, really take your finger and poke it. Yeah, you poke the steak, and then you poke your finger, and it'll, depending on how much give there is or there isn't in the steak, gives you a sense of whether it's rare, medium rare, so forth. Anyways, you may never use that again. I don't know. Now, well, when with that? Yeah, it'd be a party trick at your next barbecue, eh? Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, right? So when we say then that the hand is the manual part, also therefore then it's functional, we grip, right? So obviously, you know, we talk about opposition, bringing the thumb to little fingers, you know, and you've probably heard the term or heard the theory that, you know, this is what's allowed us to be who we are because we can oppose and grip and use tools, manual tools and so forth. So functionally, there is the power grip, which is used to grasp a cylindrical structure. So when you grab like that, that is considered to be the power grip. In other words, holding the handle of a briefcase, right? The precision handling involves a change in the handling of an object. So say you're doing precision handling when you're shredding or knitting or writing with your pen. So that's precision grips or precision handling. And then, of course, pinching is compression between the thumb and any of the fingers, depending on what's going on, but traditionally it's the index finger. And then when we look at the position of rest, it is slight flexions of the digits and the thumb is abducted. So you just let your hands just go to the side, just completely relaxed. The thumb is somewhat abducted and the fingers are somewhat flexed in the relaxed position. Okay? So we can see here we've got, you know, the power grip, we've got the precision, we've got a precision grip here as well with like a coin, we have the pinch, and we can see here is the resting position of the hand. We do have a loose grip and a firm grip depending on what we're doing as well, right? Now again, when you look, when you're going to learn in, how many people here have heard of the homunculus? The homunculus. Look it up online. Put in homunculus. H-U-M-U-N-U-C-L-U-S. It'll be this weird-looking creature with a very large face, huge hands, tiny little limbs, small bum. That's it. Okay. Okay. So what that is, that represents the amount of innervation or conversation the brain has with those parts of the body. So the larger the parts, the more sensitive, in other words, the more sensory information gets to the brain, and the smaller the parts, the less there is. And there's a couple of areas on that representation that are a lot smaller than you would think, shall we say, right? Right? Yes, you'd expect those to be more sensitive, and they're not, right? So hands are huge, right? Lips are huge. We have a lot of sensory representation in the brain when we look at it. So the hands are relatively sensitive, right? When we're able to grip and do all the things that we do with it. So, bones. On my model here, you'll see that there, we've got, this is the thumb, the first all the way to the fifth. And then we have all these little pieces of bone here, right? And if you remember from semester one, these are considered, again, like I said, anatomists, I think, smoked a lot of good weed. They said that these are cuboidal in nature. They don't look too cuboidal to me, but they do have generally six sides. And if you remember correctly, four of the sides are for articulation with other bones, and then two of the sides are for attachments of ligaments and or muscles. Okay? So although they call them cuboidal, they are uniquely shaped. But they do have an important role. They are slide-glide joints, and they allow for a lot of the movements that occur at the wrist and the hand. So these small bones are called the carpus. There are eight in total. There is a proximal row, and there is a distal row. Okay? They always list from lateral to medial in the anatomical position. So we can see here, right, we've got a proximal row and a distal row. So we've got from the thumb side, okay, we have the scaphoid, and then all the way laterally, we have the triquetrum and the pisiform. Now, have you guys palpated these in lab yet? Okay, so that's your proximal row. We'll get to all of them in a second. And then your distal row goes from trapezium thumb. So the scaphoid is on the thumb side, but the trapezium actually articulates with the metacarpal of the thumb at the saddle joint. So trapezium thumb. And then on the lateral aspect, we have the hamate. Do you want the, I'm recording here, I probably shouldn't say this, but do you want the acronym for this thing or the little poem for it? Yeah, I can do that, but it doesn't matter. Some lovers try positions that they can't handle. Okay? You'll never forget it now, will you? Some lovers try positions that they can't handle. That goes from here. Proximal row, thumb side. Some lovers try positions. And then from the thumb side, but distal, that they can't handle. Okay? Did you guys learn that at university? Is that the one you guys learned at university? Close? Okay, all right. It's the one I always remembered it by. I always found the dirtier they are, the easier I remember. Wait till you do the cranial nerves. You did do that one? Okay, all right, okay. So, I have this slide here, which makes it a little bit easier. If we take the left hand in the anatomical position, or sorry, the right hand in the left hand, we got a bit backwards here. Again, scaphoid and trapezium are lateral, trapezium thumb, and triquetrum and hamate are lateral. Pisiform is a bit of an unusual bone because the pisiform actually sits on top of the triquetrum. It's actually a sesamoid bone. It is considered a carpal bone, but it sits on top of it. In a moment here, we're going to palpate it. You're going to move it around. It's kind of funky. It actually slides and glides. All right? So remember that proximally, obviously, these are going to relate to the distal radius and ulna. Distally, the distal row is going to articulate with the metacarpals of the hand itself, okay? And then, of course, they have their own intercarpal joint between the distal and the proximal rows, okay? So we can see them here. I have a number of slides of them that kind of show them to you. And you can see how the pisiform kind of sits a little bit on top of the triquetrum. And obviously, they're named a little bit to their shapes. Okay, we've got, you know, the triquetrum will give you a sense of the number of sides. Lunate looks like a moon. Scaphoid looks like a boat, like a sailboat. We used to have two scaphoids. Did everybody know that? So you used to have a scaphoid in your foot and a scaphoid in your hand. And when we get to the foot, we'll learn it's got a different name now because it got confusing when we still got standardization of anatomical terms. So the scaphoid has stayed with the hand, and there's a bit of, it's called the navicular in the foot. Okay, but they're used to be called the scaphoid. So their names kind of will start to represent their shapes. Now, the wrist itself is the capitate lies proximal to the third metatarsal. Metatarsal, that should be metacarpal. Sorry, I never noticed that before. Okay, so the capitate lies proximal to the third metacarpal. So we look at the capitate here. It's right here. And here is your thumb here. This is your pollicis for thumb, and here is the capitate sort of in the center to the third metacarpal. So if you take your just the back of your hand and you go down the third, right, you go down the third finger, you go down the third metatarsal, and then you'll stop, and that is the capitate right there. Okay. Yeah, where it drops down a little bit into. Right. Okay. So it's sort of a way to start, shall we say, landmarking to get down into. That's your, eventually, we're going to talk a whole lot about that. Okay? So you just follow that third down, you drop in. So, you know, from there, then you can go, you know, capitate to trapezoid, trapezium, whatever, whichever direction you want it to go, that'll take you to your distal row, right? Okay? All the carpals have said six surfaces to articulate with each other, except the pisiform, which articulates just on one surface because it sits on top of its bone, okay? The posterior surface of the carpals form a broader surface than the anterior surface, so therefore we end up with this narrower anteriorly, broader posteriorly. Because of this configuration, right, they form a sulcus called the carpal tunnel, and that's held in place by ligaments to form these intercarpal joints. So we're going to discover there are a fair number of ligaments that hold these carpal bones together, but allows for a posterior broader relationship and a much narrower anterior, so we can see it. I thought I had a picture of it. This kind of. Oh, yes. They're on there, are they not? Yes, every single one of them are palpable, and you need to do it. And when you're doing joint mobilizations, you can actually slide glide each one individually. Oh, no, it's great. Feels good. Well, we'll talk about that later. Okay, so in other words, we can see that if we, I won't draw this anatomically correctly, but ultimately we can see they'll kind of look like this broadly. So posteriorly here, you'll see that it's quite large, and anteriorly you'll see it's much narrower. So this represents the carpal tunnel in relationship to the position of the carpals. So anteriorly is much smaller, and then posteriorly is much broader, which results in that carpal tunnel. Okay? We're going to talk a bit about carpal tunnel a little bit later anyways, in regards to the muscles and nerves that run through it and so forth. So, well, it's right here, sorry. So as I said, the posterior surface of the carpals form a broader surface and the anterior is narrower. They're bound tightly by ligaments to form these intercarpal joints, and the position of the carpals anteriorly form this sulcus, as you all know, is the carpal tunnel. There are 9 tendons and 1 nerve that run through this, and you will need to know all 9 tendons and what nerve. Okay, that will be something we'll be discussing. Now, the roof of the carpal tunnel is formed by a retinaculum, which is called the flexor retinaculum, and it is attached to the scaphoid and trapezium laterally and the pisiform and the hook of the hamate medially. Well, hence the reason why you're learning these palpations for these carpal bones. You're actually going to feel for each of them, so you'll get a sense of where the flexor retinaculum is. Now, quite often, people get the carpal tunnel wrong in the flexor retinaculum. They think it's kind of down here. But if you just consider, if you look at the back of your hand where your metacarpals end, your flexor retinaculum and your carpal tunnel is kind of here. It's much more proximal than you realize. So if you palpate all the way down to both the radial and the ulnar styloid processes, you are getting a sense of the distal parts of the radius and ulna. Now, distal to that is your proximal row, and distal to that is your distal row. So the carpal tunnel lies right here, not here, right in this area here, right? That's where it's found. And then you end up with, if I take a different color, do purple, then if we consider this configuration of the carpals, this flexor retinaculum finds attachment and runs right over the top like that. And then again, we've got, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 tendons that run through, and we have 1 nerve, which we'll get to all those later. All right? This is because of that carpal tunnel syndrome. What nerve did I say it was last week? Do you remember? Median. Okay? So if this gets tight for lots of reasons, like tendonitis, inflammation, pregnant ladies in their third trimester, if they're starting to retain fluid, you can actually get a pregnancy-related carpal tunnel during that last trimester. This gets pretty narrow, and that nerve gets compressed, and you end up with distal symptoms in these fingers here. Okay? All right. Let's do the proximal row first, the scaphoid. So now, where are we? We are proximal row and we are lateral, correct? Okay, we're starting lateral. So we're on the thumb side. It is considered to be boat-shaped, and it articulates proximally with the distal radius. Okay, the distal radius. It does have a prominent scaphoid tubercle. It is the largest of the proximal row, and it does provide attachment for the transverse carpal ligament. The scaphoid, along with the next one, the trapezium, forms something called the anatomical snuffbox. So what I'd like you to do is I want you to take your hand, put it in the neutral position, and I want you to abduct your thumb. And you'll find that there are 2 tendons here. Do you see the 2 tendons? I can't on this one. I'm having some thumb problems here. Do you see the 2 tendons? 1, 2. Do you see your own 2? Yeah. If you push in between those 2 tendons, You push down and you can feel the floor. You can feel a bone deep in there, right? What's that?
I would be bad at teaching stuff.
Pull back. Right in there. Yep. Did you see them? Yeah. So they actually used to put snuff in there. And it wasn't coke. It was tobacco. Can you imagine snorting tobacco? Yeah. Right? Okay, everybody's got it? This is, yeah, right there. That's the anatomical snuff box, okay? So they say that when you put your thumb down between those two tendons and you touch the bone, you are touching the scaphoid and the trapezium because they form the floor of that anatomical snuff box, okay? Now, it's a very interesting bone. It has a very poor blood supply. So if it fractures, it can die, or it can die even if there's damage to the nerve. You will all see I have a scar on my hand here. You see the scar? So I fractured my scaphoid, being an idiot, when I was 18 years old. And because of the low blood supply, I actually had to go in surgically and scrape the bone, make it bleed, take a piece out of my elbow and put a screw in, which I still have to this day. Right? And they told me I would never oppose again, but I have been able to as far as that goes. Right? I actually, in my parents' pool, decided to dive in the shallow end. And I hit the shallow end with my hands and then the bridge of my nose. So I'm kind of lucky I'm not using my tongue to move a chair around to get around, right? But the foolish things we do when we're young, right? Okay, so largest in the proximal row, considered to be boat-shaped, hence its name. It is the floor, one of the bones of the floor of the anatomical snuff box. So that's our first proximal lateral. So we can see it here, right? So if you remember we said the scaphoid along with the trapezium. So the scaphoid is in the proximal row and the trapezium is in the distal row. Again, I keep saying this, trapezium thumb. It reminds you sort of where it is, all right? You can see here, again, I don't know how they thought this looked like a boat. But whatever, I guess somebody thought that it did. Maybe a rowboat, I don't know. Next is the lunate, so we're working our way towards the medial side. It's moon-shaped, so you can see here, it kind of looks like a crescent moon a little bit, okay? It lies between the scaphoid and the triquetral, or the triquetrium. So you can see here that it lies in between. So you can see the only thing to remember is we really do have three bones in the proximal row with the pisiform sitting on top of the triquetrum, and then we have four bones across the proximal row. So you know, if you can, maybe you want to remember it that way. So you can see the lunate is here, and it is broader anteriorly than posteriorly. So we're going to remember we said that the capitate runs down by the third, okay? So we're going to go a bit further. What I would like you to do is kind of find that anatomical snuff box again and come one step medial. And I would like you to go into extension and flexion, and I want to see if you can find in extension flexion, you can feel the bone disappear and come up. Disappear and come up. Disappear and come up. Yes? Okay? This is a nasty bone for massage therapists. If you do your techniques wrong, you can sublux the lunate, and it's kind of a common problem a lot of therapists have, especially if they get in the habit of doing a lot of excessive extension in the wrist to provide techniques. Okay, so watch your techniques this week in your lab class. See if you are getting yourself in positions where you're in extensive extension like that. When you're providing your techniques, stop doing it. What you do is, if you do extension in your techniques, it's because you're getting too far over your hand. You're finding this, that's when you need to step back and lunge, because you can see how much extension disappeared if I provide my technique properly, and I'm more likely to have issues with it, or have issues if I'm in this kind of position. So keep an eye on yourself when you're doing that. What will happen is if it sublocks, that little hole that was in there in flexion or in extension, it'll disappear, and the lunate tends to kind of travel posteriorly and slide out. And all you do is you literally take your thumb and push down through into extension and kind of force it anteriorly and slides right back in again. Generally, no, what'll happen is where in extension you get that hole, it won't be there. The lunate will have slid posteriorly and filled that spot in. So that's kind of your landmark for the lunate is that flexion extension. So if you're over the lunate, you'll feel, you know, in flexion, it'll pop up, meet you, in extension, you'll feel the indentation of where the lunate was. Okay. So scaphoid, lunate, we can see it here. We can see where the articular parts are and where they articulate. Now the triquetrum is the most medial in the proximal row. It is a three-cornered bone, hence its name. So therefore, it is pyramidally shaped on the medial side of the carpus. So again, you've got to get the hand thinking of it in the anatomical position where your medial is. Now, where the scaphoid directly articulated with the radius, do you remember the disc we talked about in the distal ulna a little bit? I don't know if you remember it in the pictures. The triquetrum does not directly articulate with either the radius or the ulna. It actually articulates with the articular disc that we find at the distal radio ulnar joint. Okay? We're going to talk a bit about that when we get to the wrist joint. But understand that the triquetrum does actually just articulate with the disc. So we can see it here, the pisiform, which we're going to do here in a moment. You can see it, the pisiform sitting on top of the green, which is the green kind of color here is kind of the triquetrum that we see here, and the pisiform on top. So that we have this smooth facet here for the pisiform, which has been removed here, and then we can see where it articulates with the lunate, right, which would be the more lateral to it in the row. Okay, the pisiform is a small P-shaped bone that lies on the palmar surface of the triquetrum, and as we just learned earlier, it is an attachment point for the flexor retinaculum of the carpal tunnel. So, what I'd like you to do now is go to that medial aspect of your wrist, right? So, if you look at this point, of course, your floor of your anatomical snuff box represents your scaphoid. Then you've got your lunate, and then you've got your triquetrum, which is the most lateral proximal part, and come a little bit on top of the triquetrum, and you'll feel a hard little P. Okay, everybody's got that? Okay, got an idea of it? Now try it on your partner. See if you can find that hard little P. It'll be right at that medial aspect of where the little finger is. Okay. Once you find it, grab hold of it with your thumb and forefinger and make it slide and glide. Can you feel it move? Yeah. Some people might be crunchy.
This one here.
See? Yep, that's it right there.
Yeah.
Feel it move?
Yeah, I was
thinking. Okay. Hey. That's the pisiform. So that's your proximal row, scaphoid, lunate, triquetrum, with the pisiform anterior to the triquetrum, which is one of the attachment points for the flexor retinaculum. Okay? Now, what you're going to do in lab is you're going to grab each one of those and make them slide and glide eventually. Okay? Distal row. Yeah, and if you've not been doing your techniques properly, you might find these kind of tight. These are the ones, again, you've got to be taking care of with your techniques as a massage therapist because they can become a problem. So now we are on the distal row, and again, we're starting laterally. I'll say it again, trapezium thumb, okay? It is a four-sided bone on the lateral side of the carpus. It articulates with both the first and second metacarpals, the scaphoid, and the trapezoid. So if you think of the first and second, we have to remember, first is the thumb, second is the index. So if we follow those metacarpal bones down, right, both of these articulate with it. So we can see here that here's the thumb, the trapezium. We can see there's an articulation here with the metacarpal of the first, and then there's a small articulation right here with part of the second that we can see here. we can see that it does articulate with the scaphoid in the proximal row, and then medial to it, it also articulates with the trapezoid next, which is the next one we're going to talk about in it. So we can see here that we've got, here's the articulation here for the scaphoid that we can see here. Here is the articulation for the first metacarpal, which is quite large, and we have a much smaller surface here for articulation with the second metacarpal, which would be this small little area here that we can see. Okay? So it articulates with the first and second metacarpal, scaphoid, and trapezoid bones. The next is the trapezoid. Again, it sort of represents, the name represents sort of the shape of it. So it is a wedge-shaped bone that resembles somewhat the trapezium. It articulates directly with the second metacarpal. So when we looked at trapezium, it articulated with both the first and the second. The trapezoid only articulates with the second metacarpal. And it also articulates with the trapezium, which we just talked about. It will then articulate with the next carpal, as we had medially, the capitate, and it does articulate with the scaphoid. So we can see here, we have an articulation with the second, we have an articulation with the trapezium, we have an articulation with the scaphoid, and we have an articulation with the capitate. All right. Now remember, we need movement between these bones in order for the wrist to function properly. So some of the things you might be doing down the road is actually assessing the movement of these bones in relationship to each other with your patient to see if it's actually affecting their ability to be able to do many of the movements that the wrist joint actually does. I know it seems kind of picky, doesn't it? Next is the capitate. Caput equals head in Latin, not to end. Like the Italians use it. It's a head-shaped bone with a rounded extremity, and it's the largest bone in the carpus. So your scaphoid is the largest in the proximal row, but the capitate is the largest in all of the carpals. It articulates primarily with the third metacarpal distally and with the trapezoid, scaphoid, lunate, and hamate. So we can see how large it is here fitting in. So we can see, even in mine, here, so here's the thumb. So this is the scaphoid, right? Then this is the, what was next? Right, the lunate, and then the, right, okay. Then we can see here, so we've got, you can kind of see a bit of the saddle joint here, right, when we looked at the trapezium. And then we did the trapezoid, which is this small little one here. So when I'll pass this around a bit so you can look at it, but you'll see where, you can see how the trapezium articulates with the first, but it also somewhat articulates with the second. And then we've got, right, you can see just how big the cap, right, this capitate is. It's significantly large as compared to the others, okay? And we can see the articulation again, lunate, scaphoid, trapezoid, and the third. Not the fourth, no, because that would be the hamate that articulates with the...
Like, I'm just off the picture, but it's like...
And maybe just the way the diagram is. Yeah. The next is the hamate. Again, an attachment site for the flexor retinaculum, and it has a bit of a hook on it. So it's wedge-shaped on the medial side of the hand. It articulates with both the fourth and the fifth metacarpals, the capitate, and the tricuspid bones. As I said, it has a distinctive hooked process called the hook of a hamate. It extends anteriorly, and the hook is palpable. So we're going to do it for fun. I'm going to get ahead of the game on Michelle here. Okay, so take your patient's hand, therapist. I don't care who does what. Okay, you're going to take this interphalangeal joint of the thumb. Here, come on up here just for a sec, we'll use you. Okay, so we're going to come over here, and I'm going, actually let's use this thing, because my, so the thumb isn't working very well. So we've got the pisiform here, yes, on the proximal row. I'm going to take that interphalangeal joint, and I'm going to put it on the pisiform, pointing it at the second finger, and I'm just going to bring my thumb down, and that's the hook. So the interphalangeal joint on the pisiform, just bring the thumb down, there's the hook right there. Okay, try that. You come a little too. Got to keep that thumb in and just bring it down. Nope. There's the pisiform. Okay. Put the thumb. You're fighting the deal. Okay. That goes right on there, and just bring the thumb down. That's the hook right there. Okay.
So, underneath the pisiform.
This goes on the pisiform, and then this goes down. So you need that distance. So you're on the pisiform there. So that's the pisiform there. So you want to be here on the pisiform, and you just drop down. That's where the hook is down here. So the pisiform is here, so a little bit further. You don't.
It's a little bit deeper.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, yeah, good. Okay. Found the pisiform?
Yeah.
Now put your interphalangeal joint. So this point here, and just drop down. There's the hook right there.
Is it in there?
Yes.
Oh, way down.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you want to walk up with your thumb and go down, right? It's not straight down. So you can see the hook right here. And it is one of the attachment points for the carpal tunnel in the proximal row. Or the flexor retinaculum of the carpal tunnel, or the roof of the carpal tunnel. Okay? Now, the proximal surfaces of the distal row of carpal bones articulate with the proximal row of the carpal bones, and the distal surface of the distal row of the carpals articulate with the metacarpals. Does that make sense? The proximal surface of the distal row of carpal bones articulates with the proximal of carpal bones. That makes sense? Yes? Right? And the distal surface of the distal row of carpals articulate with the metacarpals. If we look here, we're saying that the proximal part of the distal row articulates with the proximal group of carpals, right? And the distal surfaces of the distal row articulate with the metacarpals. Okay? Yes. Yes, they do. They do. So the distal surfaces of the proximal row articulate with the distal row, and the proximal surfaces of the proximal row articulate with the distal radius ulna. Okay? Okay. So the metacarpals. There are five. Makes sense, right? One for each finger. They're miniature long bones, and they run from the carpals to the phalanges. Number one is the shortest, and really kind of considerably shorter. So you can see here when we sort of put them all together, you can see here just how short the fifth is. Actually, this one might work a bit better. Okay, so we can see that this is the first here, which would be the thumb. Then the second, third, fourth, and fifth. So you can see it's a bit stockier, quite a bit shorter, okay? And that would represent the first that articulates and is the first digit, which, of course, is the thumb, which we can see here, all right? Heads are at the distal ends and articulate with the proximal phalanges to form the knuckles, and the proximal end is the base. So you just take a moment and make a fist. Just make a fist and look at your knuckles in your fist. Those are the heads. So in relationship to the metacarpals, proximally is the base that articulates with the carpals. Distally, those knuckles, those are the heads. That's the heads of the metacarpals. Okay? Knucklehead. There you go. Okay? The first metacarpal is the thickest and shortest. And the third metacarpal has a stylite process on the lateral side of its base. Okay, so we can see here we've got, again, short, stocky first, second, third, fourth, and fifth. And you can see, again, these are the heads distally, and these are the bases proximally. Okay, so the knuckles are the heads. The dorsal surface of each hand, where's the dorsal surface? In the anatomical position, where would that be? Right. The back of the hand. Okay, good. The dorsal surface of each head has a small tubercle for the attachment of collateral ligaments. So when we look at these metacarpals, right, okay, we have this attachment of these collateral ligaments. So on each side of each of these are collateral ligaments that do help support the joints here. The body is concave on both sides for muscle attachments of a muscle we'll learn later called the dorsal interossei. So when we look at the configuration here, that one's not a very good color. We have, shall we say, we have the heads here, we have the bases here, and they go like this. So you have this concavity here, which allows for muscles to attach here, which we'll be taking later, called the dorsal interossei. The name tells you exactly that. Found on the dorsal surface, and interossei means between interossei, between bone. Right. Not complicated. Okay? The base of the third metacarpal on the dorsal side is a common site for a cyst. So if we look at the base on the dorsal side, and that would be where the third would articulate with the, right, the capitate. Okay. Occasionally, there is a sesamoid bone found at the first and second metacarpal. So you will see occasionally in diagrams, you will see here that artists will sometimes put sesamoid bones here on the first, right? And it has to do with muscle tendons will run through this and affect the thumb, which does, again, allow for sort of a pulley type of configuration when it's flexing, okay? These are good pictures. You get a sense of them. Again, heads, shafts, bases, proximal row, distal row, right? And then we'll get into the phalanges. Phalanges sort of represent your, yes? Not to any great extent that you would recognize or know. It could be something that's becoming over time a bit more redundant. We definitely have them in the first and the foot, but some do have them. When they make a statement like that in any textbook, it means that during their dissections, they have found some specimens don't have sesamoid bones, and maybe many of them do when they're doing them. So they're just making a comment on, you know, in terms of their dissections, they're not necessarily seeing a sesamoid in every single one. Do you guys get that deep in your dissection? We talked about, don't remember? Okay.
I don't think.
Okay, I'd love to do dissections. I think it would be so cool to do dissections. So the phalanges are miniature long bones. Each digit has three except the first. So fingers 2, 3, 4, and 5 have three bones, right? Okay, phalangeal bones. The thumb first only has two. So if we look at it from a joint perspective, the thumb has one interphalangeal joint, where all the other fingers have a proximal interphalangeal joint and a distal interphalangeal joint. And we'll get to those when we get to the joints. We generally tend to call them pips and dips. Pips and dips. Each has a head, of course, which is distal, the same as the metacarpals, and a base that is proximal. And, of course, between the base and the head is the shaft. The proximal are the largest and the distal are the smallest. Okay, so whether it's the thumb or fingers, proximal tend to be the largest, and as we move towards the tips of the fingers, they get quite a bit smaller. They do, as we get distal, the shafts do taper and get smaller and smaller and smaller as we head more distally. Now, when we look at the terminal end, so at the very last phalange of the fingers, so when we look at, you know, sort of where that pad of the distal finger is, the terminal phalanges are flattened and expanded at their distal ends, and this is lies just under the nail bed. So think of where your nail is. That flange has come out and flattened. So you can see there's a bit of a flat. See the flat right here? And that sort of represents just under the nail bed, where just the flange is flattened out. I don't know. You can see it much better here, how much it's flattened. And that little tip lies just right underneath your nail bed. Now, I have had a couple of students in my experience in massage programs who on one digit or two are missing distal phalanges. I had one young lady who did not have one in her thumb and literally could bend the tip of her thumb and bend it all the way backwards. It was just flesh. There was no bone in there. It was just a genetic thing in terms of development. So you can sort of see how it flattens out.
Yeah.
See how it flattens out? Okay. See how it's flat? All right. I don't know what it looks like on those, but you can see how flat it actually gets on the real ones. And that's just under the nail bed. Right? Just under the nail bed. You know, it kind of widens out and flattens. Okay, you can see how it just sort of becomes wide and flat. Again, that's just under the nail. You know, it flattens and widens out. I don't think it's quite as good. There's not bad, though. As you can see it here, for sure.
Is this your actual bone?
These are actual bones. Wow. You can see, though, they're quite delicate, and some of the tips broken off and all sorts of things. Now, this individual may have had some sort of malformation here on the little finger, but you can see here, so here's the thumb. You can see how much thicker everything is in the thumb, but still, the distal still flattens out to make the thumb. Okay.
I cannot do this automatically, but...
You can.
Yeah.
But that's a particular muscle. So you have one muscle that will cross this joint, another muscle that crosses both joints. We're going to talk a whole lot about that. It's coming. So you can see how it flattens out.
Oh, yeah.
At the end. That would be right under the nail bed. You see it?
Is that why if you, like, slam your finger in a door, you can, like in a car door or something, you could...
Oh, you can just crush this thing. Yeah, just crush it or snap it. Yeah.
Slam your thumb and, like, her whole, like, thumb is, like...
Yeah. Ugh, that would hurt. Okay, so that's the bones. Now we have the joints. And where'd it go? What up? Oh, I'm in the wrong one, that's why. Okay. So obviously we have a lot of articulations here. They're all synovial joints, which then of course means that there's joint capsule, synovial membrane, synovial fluid, joint spaces, on and on and on. And of course, again, because they're synovial joints, there's lots of ligaments that have to hold these all together. And you can imagine from, you know, just looking at the carpal bones themselves and all those articulations, we have to have lots of ligaments that hold all of that together, right? So we've got a lot of ligaments involved here as well. So the radiocarpal joint, which represents the wrist. So we can see here is your distal radius. Here's your distal ulna. Here's the disc I was talking about. So remember, we do have a distal radial ulnar joint, right? Okay. And remembering that in pronation supination, the radius spins around the distal ulna. Well, because there's articulation here, with the scaphoid and the lunate and its associated ligaments, then of course when the radius comes over top of the ulna, the hand follows, right? Which we call pronation and supination, okay? When we look at the distal radius, or right, distal ulna, the ulna is a bit shorter. So to make up the difference, there is a disc that lies here between the distal ulna and the lunate triquetrum. So in other words, the ulna does not directly articulate with the wrist joint. there is a disc here. And because we have a disc, so we have the distal radial ulnar joint, and then we have the disc that lies between the distal ulna and the proximal carpal row, then we have this L-shaped synovial joint that fits in between the two. So it actually provides a synovial membrane and fluid and so forth between the distal ulna and the disc, and between the distal ulna and the distal radius at the radial ulnar, distal radial ulnar joint. Everybody follow? So before we get into them, because of all these joints in here, this is the amount of ligaments that you have in your hand, holding all of these in place, holding them all in place. Who cares? No, you do not. No, you do not. No, you do not. Just the names I used. So it just makes sense, right? With the amount of movement that can occur here, we need a lot of holding elements to keep these all in place. And at the same time, we have ligaments that maintain the carpal tunnel as well, right? That curve of the relationship of the carpal bones. So the radial carpal joint is the wrist. So the reason we call it the radial carpal joint is because of the disc. We wouldn't call it the radial ulnar carpal joint. It actually, this is the true wrist joint, this radial carpal joint. It is condyloid, and so we have the radius and articular disc that articulate with the bones of the proximal carpal row. Remember that you don't see the term ulna there. The ulna does not articulate with the proximal row of the carpals, okay? The disc does. So the radius articulates directly with the carpals, and then the disc does. So you have a convex surface of carpal bones fitting into a concave surface of the distal radial and the articular disc. So the distal radius and articular disc form a concavity, and the proximal row of the carpal bones is a convexity, hence the reason why it's condyloid. Remember, the ulna does not articulate with the carpal bones, but does articulate with the disc. So it's a synovial joint, so therefore we need a fibrous capsule, so it encloses this full joint around. It is completely strengthened by dorsal, palmar radial carpal ligaments, and radial and ulnar collateral ligaments. So let's think about that for a minute. So dorsal would be on the back between the distal radius and ulna to the carpals, right? Then palmar radial carpal joints. So that would be on the palmar surface between the carpal bones and the distal radius, right? And then we have radial and ulnar collateral ligaments, which would mean what? These are ones that run on either side, lateral and medial, in relationship to those, yes? So we have palmar ligaments, dorsal ligaments, and collateral ligaments on either side. Okay? Yep. Palmar, dorsal, collateral. Okay? See, here's your radial collateral here on that radial side, and here is your ulnar collateral here on the ulnar side. So we have them on either side here. This is the palmar ligaments running across that wrist joint, and this is your dorsal on the top. Okay? So you have a significant amount here that allows for support in this relationship of all these bones. So these are the ones you do need to know. The palmar radial carpal ligaments are very strong, and they pass from the radius to the both rows of the carpals on the palmar surface. They're placed in such a way in the relationship to these bones that it ensures that the hand follows the radius during supination. So these are the ligaments that are responsible that the hand follows the radius when it's coming back off of the anterior part of the ulna back into the anatomical position. So it is these palmar ligaments that ensure that the hand follows when we go from here to here. It is these ligaments, okay? The dorsal radial carpal ligaments, is the same as the palmar ligaments, but on on the dorsal surface, right? Makes sense, right? Fundamentally. And it is the dorsal radial carpals that ensure that the hand follows the radius during pronation. So the palmar are responsible for the hand following the radius in supination, and is the dorsal ligaments that ensure that the hand follows the radius in pronation. Okay? Yeah, pretty much. The collaterals are exactly that. They lie on either side. So the ulnar collateral ligament is on the medial aspect of the wrist. It goes from the ulnar styloid process to the triquetrum. So you think of where that ulnar styloid process is to the triquetrum on that medial aspect between the hand, between the carpals and the distal radius ulna. And then the radial collateral ligament strengthens the wrist joint laterally. It attaches from the radial styloid process to the scaphoid. Now, this ligament is palpable. So if you find the radial styloid process, you're going to drop down into a bit of a soft spot into that anatomical snuff box, yes? Okay? So once you're in there, take your wrist and move it ulnarly, and you'll feel that ligament will tighten right up under your finger. Yeah, you feel that? Okay? You feel the tendons too, so you have to get around those on either side of the anatomical snuff box. You need to go a bit deeper from that radial styloid process in, but you will feel the radial styloid, radial collateral ligament will tighten under you when you're doing this. Okay? This is called ulnar deviation. This is called radial deviation. Sometimes the textbooks say adduction, abduction of the wrist. But I've always known them as ulnar deviation, radial deviation. Potatoes, potatoes, right? And you know, that'll come a lot more into sort of assessments and those sorts of things. What happened here? Hello? Did I turn this off? There we go. So you can see here, here's your palmar radial carpal ligaments here, which palmar is responsible for hand in supination. Here are your dorsal radial carpal ligaments here for hand following in pronation. And then we can see here in yellow and green, yellow is the radial collateral ligament, and the green is ulnar collateral. And you can somewhat feel the ulnar collateral ligament too when you go into radial deviation. All right? Ultimately, of course, is remember, ligaments are responsible for their holding elements or holding all these structures together in their relationship to each other. So what does the wrist joint do? It adducts, which I just showed you. It abducts, right? So adduction is also known as ulnar deviation. Abduction, also known as radial deviation. Flexion and extension and circumduction. It does not rotate. Rotation, which looks like it's rotating, it's not. It's actually supinating and pronating because of the relationship to the radius as it moves back and forth in relationship to the ulna, right? Okay. Intercarpal joints. So these are the joints between all those carpal bones. They interconnect the carpal bones, and they are plane synovial. So in other words, the carpal bones in relationship to each other slide and glide, okay? Yeah. Oh, that's my name. These are the joints between the carpals of the distal row. So we do have, we have a mid-carpal joint, okay? So the mid-carpal joint is between the proximal and distal rows of the carpal bones. So we can see here, here is our radial carpal joint, which we just talked about, which is the true wrist joint, okay? Then we have the mid-carpal joint, which runs between the proximal and distal rows that we can see here, okay? By the way, here's a nice look at the, you can see kind of how the relationship is here. You can see it's broader here in its relationship. But here's your, again, your triquetrum, lunate, and scaphoid. Here's your, the disc, and then this is your proximal radial carpal joint, the true wrist joint, and then you have your intercarpal joint that we see here, okay? The piezo triquetral joint, of course, is formed from the articulation of the pisiform, with the palmar surface of the triquetrum, and when you did palpate it, you grabbed that piece of foam, you did kind of slide it and glide it a bit, and that's what you were measuring here. Now, with these intercarpal joints, there is a joint capsule, and it is a common articular cavity. So it's a common articular cavity that's formed by the intercarpal and carpal metacarpal joints, with the exception of the thumb. So all four of these share, and the thumb's all by its lonesome. Okay, when you're looking at the carpal metacarpal joints. So the intercarpal and carpal metacarpal joints are all together, which includes the thumb side. But when we get to the carpal metacarpal joint of the thumb, it's independent on its own. That's the saddle joint. So if you want to kind of write that in, you know, we always talk about how the thumb is a saddle joint. It's the carpal metacarpal joint of the thumb that's the true thumb saddle joint. Okay? And you can see it here in the real bones that I have if you want to look later. So, common articular cavity for the intercarpals and carpal metacarpal joints. And the only thing is the carpal metacarpal joint of the thumb is independent. Otherwise, all the carpals share the same joint capsule. Okay? The fibrous capsule surrounds the intercarpal joints, helping to unite them. And the synovial membrane lines the fibrous layer. It's attached to the margins of the articular surfaces of the carpal. So we have a nice joint space there with synovial fluid, which allows the interaction of all the sliding and gliding that occurs. We can see them here as well. Do you guys need a break? Okay, let's take a break.